The prosaic fact is that despite a great expenditure of time, effort, and money, no really convincing evidence has been found to support such beliefs. There are better uses for the taxpayers' dollars than support of Project Blue Book.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad, as always, to be in the pocket with you as we go careening all through space and time in pursuit of the enigmatic, like we do every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. And, of course, listen on demand via podcasts on your iPhone or on other devices, anywhere, anytime, anywhere around the world. Let's lock in. Oh, and of course, May the 4th be with you. Very special day for all you sci-fi fans out there. We've got a lot in store, including what a Hubble photograph sounds like. That's right. More on that a little later. Also, how Halley's Comet is playing a role in things that are going to be happening tonight. Some news about a famous Martian meteorite that actually may involve Martians, or at least something kind of close to that. But later in the program, we are going to be taking a look back at the way that the UFO subject has changed, and more importantly, how attitudes toward it have shifted over time, and largely in a result of the way that a couple of factors have influenced public attitudes about it. Media coverage in large mainstream American newspapers, and of course also scientific studies that have sought to understand whether there was a phenomenon, but also which I think it's very fair to say, and there is plenty of historical evidence for this, they have also essentially steered the narrative with various intentions. Those are, of course, involving economic considerations, military and government attitudes about the phenomenon, scientists essentially working to try and prevent mass panic, and also belief in things that they feel there isn't enough evidence for. And as is evidenced by news we touched on last week, with the DOD officially releasing three videos that have existed in the public domain now for quite a while, but which they say were unauthorized for release. This is big news because, of course, as we heard, the DOD is now saying, we want to make sure that those who have said these videos may not be real know that these videos are, in fact, legitimate. They do come from the government, but we don't know what they are. And while many have pointed out the fact that there has surprisingly been very little coverage of this otherwise historic moment in UFO research, it's also not surprising that that would be the case right now with everything going on in the world, namely the coronavirus pandemic. But, of course, thinking more broadly about things, this is a result of some pressure, I think, that has been building since late 2017, when, for what is certainly not the first time in American history, or in the history of this subject in a global sense, the narrative has shifted somewhat. Attitudes have somewhat changed, and now UFOs are not only popular, but a lot of people in academic and other professions are advocating study of the phenomenon based on new information forthcoming. I'm here tonight to tell you that that is not a new development in the history of this topic, but what we need to try and understand is what has caused what one scholarly friend of mine, Mr. Peter Robbins of New York, has in the past referred to as the UFO ridicule factor. And let me tell you, this is one heck of a story. So we'll be diving into that a little later. Of course, right here at the outset as we are covering news, I have to begin by wishing you all a happy May the 4th in that great annual tradition celebrated by Star Wars fans. Or, as the Jedi like to say, of course,
the Force will be with you. Always.
In the words of Obi-Wan himself, probably no better time than the present to be reminded of that, because, of course, a lot of folks in recent weeks have been going through hardships, and it's definitely been a difficult and trying time. But I'm here to remind you on this May the 4th that there isn't any try, in all of this. We all should try our best. We should all try to do what we can. But if there is really one lesson that hardships teach us, it is, as I have often reiterated, that humans will overcome challenges and difficulty, we will persist, and we will prevail. And arguably, under such circumstances, you don't really have a whole lot of room for try. You just do. You forge ahead, and you do. You succeed. Although, no one ever said it better than another great scholar of the Jedi Order, Jedi Master Yoda, who once said,
"Try not. Do. Or do not. There is no try."
I feel that there's a lot of wisdom in those words, and it's important for us to remember them right now, as, for the time being, many states are beginning to reopen, temperatures are gradually beginning to increase. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, but again, there are some signs of a light at the end of the tunnel, although we've got to be realistic about things. We've got to be practically minded, and I think it's safe to say at this time that the coronavirus threat is far from over. But if you think about the Star Wars films, that's kind of an ongoing theme. You know, the Rebel Alliance fighting against this authoritarian regime and doing what they can to restore balance and order to the galaxy. But periodically with time, new versions of it arise. Sometimes the threat goes underground. Sometimes the threat is so insidious that it is virtually unseen but remains ever present. The dark side, in other words. And in real life, as we all know, although it takes many shapes and forms, there is such a thing as a dark side, and we might argue that there is such a thing as a force as well. That force that unites us during times of trouble and strife, and that force that has always, time and time again, and continues to this day to show that we, as humans, will prevail in the face of any kind of challenge, whether that's a pandemic. We will prevail, we will do, we will not try, and the Force will be with us, and may it be with all of you this May 4th, and always, my friends. And with that, we will get over into some news. I'd mentioned that tonight there would be something happening, and all you stargazers may be excited to hear, that the second recent meteor shower will be occurring, which involves the Eta Aquarids. That's an annual meteor shower that occurs every year in early May. But this year, it reaches its climax tonight as of the day that we are recording, which is Monday. Those of you who are awake really early on Tuesday morning, you may also see it. This shower, they say, happens to be one of, if not the best, in the Southern Hemisphere. So right here in my neck of the woods, that's the ideal place to be watching for this. And on any clear, warm night, as many of you guys know, I may very well have a telescope out. I happen to know that my good pal Jeff Smith often does the exact same thing. And keep in mind, even if you haven't got a telescope, a good pair of binoculars often is just as good for stargazing, but if you're looking for meteors, it's going to be difficult to see those through a telescope or even binoculars at times. Often, if meteors are what you're after, then the naked eye will do you just fine. Might actually do a little better because you're able to see more of the sky. But they say this year the meteor shower will be peaking just two nights before the final supermoon of 2020, and so the bright moon may make it a little difficult for some to see the fainter meteors, although you should still be able to see a few. But AccuWeather.com, reporting on tonight's shower, noted that many of the meteor showers throughout the year are caused by debris left by comets when they visit the inner solar system. And when the debris enters the Earth's atmosphere, it burns incredibly bright for a few brief seconds. The majority of visible meteors are caused by particles ranging in size from about half of a small pebble down to a grain of sand, and generally weigh less than 1 to 2 grams. The debris that causes the Eta Aquarids, though, is actually dust left behind by one of the most famous comets of all. That's right, Halley's Comet. Halley's only orbits the sun once every 75 years, but each year in early May, the Earth passes through some of the debris that it has left behind, and so even if we don't see the comet itself, we're able to see where it has been this time of the year every year. And hey, since we talked with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum last week about the track line left by the subject of the famous Patterson-Gimlin film, maybe we could kind of think of the Eta Aquarids as the track line of Halley's Comet, footprints left by a celestial object. That's really interesting. Now, you can see, of course, those meteors as long as the moon isn't so bright that it outshines them. But far less often are you able to hear the kinds of things that our astronomers are out there looking for. But recently, that was made possible for us, thanks in part to NASA, utilizing an image that was captured by the Hubble Space Telescope, which was subsequently sonified. According to Science Alert, the image NASA used, they say, for this project was taken by the Hubble's Advanced Camera for Surveys and Wide Field Camera 3 back in August 2018, and Lauren was kind enough to get an audio rendition for us of the sonified photograph, which you're about to hear. Everybody ready? You may want to adjust the volume, especially if you're wearing headphones. If you've ever wondered what space sounds like, you're about to hear it. You know, really, that's just about what I would expect space to sound like. I'm actually not all that surprised, not in the least, in fact. But that's still enjoyable to hear. I don't know. I've heard some news outlets referring to it as chilling or eerie. I mean, that sounds an awful lot like, well, maybe 1950s cheesy sci-fi music as well. That kind of comes to mind. But that is a sonification of a Hubble Deep Space image, ladies and gents. So now you know what space sounds like, what it actually sounds like. I'd mentioned also that we had some Martian news. Space.com reporting that apparently the famed Mars meteorite Allen Hills 84001 has now apparently been confirmed to contain 4 billion year old native organic molecules, the carbon containing building blocks of life as we know it, according to a new study. But wait, there is more, because Space.com also reports that the organics contain nitrogen, which is another ingredient that Earth life depends on, and were found within carbonate minerals, which usually form in groundwater. So the discovery, they say, adds to an emerging picture of a wet and potentially habitable Mars, but not today. That would have occurred in the distant past. But it also raises further questions about the idea that maybe certain building blocks of life could have traveled to Earth from other nearby planets, in which case it has been proposed more than once that we might all end up being Martians in one sense or another. Here's some really exciting news, something I'm really happy to hear about. Now, I'm the kind of guy, as you all know, who respects all life. Even though I respect all forms of life, I also probably should note the caveat that I enjoy certain life forms a little more than I do others. And so I'm not necessarily going to put the murder hornet in the enjoyable camp, especially with the news that they have apparently arrived here in the U.S. And more concerning than the idea of a 4-centimeter-long hornet is what they do to bees. I'm reading that they apparently can attack a nest of honeybees and decimate their entire hive within just a few hours. So you add to the fact that there are what are appropriately called murder hornets now found in the United States, add to that how dangerous they can be to our already dwindling honeybee populations, and it sounds like a real recipe for a problem, if you ask me. CBS News reporting on this, they say a roughly 2-inch-long insect known as the murder hornet has made its way to the U.S. for the first time ever, according to researchers. It's known by another name also, the Asian giant hornet, or Vespa mandarinia. And honeybees aren't all that it is capable of killing. In fact, they say that this particular insect has been known to kill up to 50 people a year in Japan. That according to the New York Times. So in addition to endangering honeybees, humans might be at risk as well. And at times like these, actually, I gotta throw my pen on the table for this one. Lauren and I were talking as we were getting show prep together last night, and I actually have to credit her for this because I think that she had expressed a similar sentiment even before I did. But I had said to her, if you told me in advance of the arrival of 2020 that this year we would have a global pandemic, that the Department of Defense would post an official release on their website acknowledging the official release of videos of unidentified flying objects, and that there were 2-inch-long murder hornets that would begin to appear in the United States capable of decimating honeybee populations and also killing people in some instances, I'd have called you a liar. I would not have believed that all those things would arrive in 1 year. I mean, it's getting to the point that I'm almost ready to run and take cover. Actually, I already have. I do this broadcast every week from a bunker below ground, and there's good reason why. So for years, for all those folks who had said I was crazy, living underground, never coming out, never seeing the light of a day, now you know. And remember, knowing, friends, is half the battle. We head over to the UK now. The National Post reporting that apparently somebody has really been taking the current pandemic situation maybe a little too seriously, as they have been strolling around one particular UK town dressed as a 17th century plague doctor. You know, those masks that look like a combination between maybe a World War I gas mask and a great big bird beak. Yeah, those things. They say that in images posted online by Jade Gosbell and first reported by the Press Association, this person can be seen crossing a recreational area decked out in the aforementioned garb, that of the famous doctors whose outfits became a symbol of death. I don't know, though. This person might actually be serious. Maybe they're just trying to freak everybody out. This is the next big rage. It was freaky clowns a few years back, and now it's going to be plague doctors, pandemic style. Maybe that's really what's going on here. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Why don't you send me an email, info@micahanks.com, or you can always tweet at me at @MicahHanks. Like to hear from you guys that way, too. What else have we got? Oh, here's one. I don't know what's been on your mind lately. If you're like me, maybe you just don't sleep all that well in general. Doesn't help, by the way, that of course Coast to Coast AM broadcasts in my time zone from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m., and so I was the guest, along with my fantastic pal John Greenwald, the other night, Saturday night. We'll talk more about that in the next segment, but vampire hours are the norm if you are a frequent guest on late night radio. And Jimmy Church was the fill-in host on Saturday, and he'd said, you know, we've got you on for the 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. time slot. Does that work? And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm usually awake at that time anyway. My normal biphasic sleep pattern puts me down for a few hours. I usually get up in the middle of the night, whether or not I really actually get up and walk around or anything like that. Often I just lay there in bed, and I've really gotten to be fond of listening to audiobooks in those wee hours of the morning, because that way I can continue to process information even if I don't want to turn on the light and contribute to eye strain. Audiobooks are really great for that, huh? But a lot of people may be having sleepless nights for other reasons. And Science Alert also reports that one of the interesting side effects currently that many people are reporting about the coronavirus pandemic is a lot of really vivid dreams. And as they report here, those kinds of dreams can sometimes be confusing or distressing, but dreaming, of course, is normal and considered helpful in processing our waking situation, which for many people is far from normal at the moment. Now, if you're anything like me, you'll often dream about things that are about to occur in the real world, but it's going to be a weird, almost Looney Tunes-style parody version of things that are actually going to happen. And I've always kind of compared dreams to being virtual reality. Our mind is kind of processing and running through a simulation of things that are going to happen. And so in my dreams, if I've got a Skype call with somebody the next day, I might dream that there's an actual meeting where I get on a plane and fly across the world to meet somebody, and there's a big conference going on at a hotel where we meet face-to-face, and then a fire breaks out or something insane like that. Well, I suppose, as they're reporting here, probably a lot of people in light of the pandemic, they are having dreams like that right now. And they note here, of course, that when we sleep, we go through different stages which cycle throughout the night, and this includes light and deep sleep, and a period known, of course, as REM, kind of like the famous band, and that features more prominently in the second half of the night. Dreams can occur within all sleep stages, but REM sleep, of course, is considered responsible for highly emotive and visual dreams. Now, bearing all that in mind, as they report here, this global pandemic and the associated restrictions may have had impacts on how and when we sleep. They say this has positive effects for some and negative effects for others, but both situations can lead to heightened recollection of dreams in addition to the more vivid dreams that some are describing. Or one may read from that we always have vivid dreams, but maybe our recollection of them has been temporarily enhanced. Ruminating about the pandemic, either directly or via the media just before going to bed, can work against our need to relax and get a good night's sleep. It may also provide fodder for dreams. When we are sleep deprived, they say the pressure for REM sleep increases, and so at the next sleep opportunity, a so-called rebound in REM sleep occurs. During this time, dreams are reportedly even more vivid and emotional than usual. So it sounds like, indeed, there are some factors with regard to the pandemic and some concerns people have had about it that are affecting people's dreams. But hey, like I have already recommended, if you're having trouble sleeping at night and you don't want to lay awake and think and worry all night, try an audiobook. Those really help. And of course, if staying awake and alert is something you're trying to do, as some have pointed out, the music we play on this program is aimed at doing just that. So let's keep it alert, and we'll be back right here on the Micah Hanks program. Where the coffee is as strong as the days are long. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. Proud as always to be here with you and keeping you guys company. As podcasts are being downloaded around the globe en masse. You know, actually in recent months we've seen quite an uptick in downloads, and so I want to thank all you guys who are spreading the word. Remember, of course, if you do like this show, consider sharing it on social media. Tell your friends about it. Tell folks how they can listen, where they can find it. It's always easy to find because it's all available right there at MicahHanks.com. I've taken a lot of pains over the last couple of years to make essentially everything that I do available in one place, because in this social media age, it really helps if things are easy to find. You don't want things, your web properties all scattered all over the place. And so, yeah, MicahHanks.com, simple as that. You'll find everything I do right there. Now, like I mentioned, the other night I actually was a guest on Coast to Coast AM. Jimmy Church was filling in for the weekend shift, and he invited John Greenwald of the Black Vault onto the program for hours 1 and 2, and then I went on immediately after him, and I really think this was a fantastic experience, both because it was an honor to be asked to get on late night radio, a nationally syndicated program like Coast to Coast, and talk about some of the impact and some of the implications of the DOD's acknowledgement of these three UFO videos. I was equally glad to see that John Greenwald and some of the work he's been doing in an effort toward getting more transparency from government in relation to the UFO subject was kind of showcased, because as he pointed out during his portion of the show, there have been many instances in the last several months where there had been efforts spearheaded by John Greenwald and also other journalists who are good friends of this program come to mind, Tim McMillan and Brett Tingley as well. Those guys will publish an article, and then the mainstream media will jump on it, rewrite the article, get a separate confirmation from a Pentagon spokesperson, which they publish, and sometimes they will completely leave out the names or the other publications associated with actually breaking the story, which is kind of ironic, considering, as we're going to look at over the course of the rest of this week's program, the history of large media outlets in America downplaying subjects like UFOs. Rather funny that they would take information from independent researchers like Greenwald and repackage it as though it were a discovery of their own original reporting. And so in the worst instances, we could call that bad journalism, but it's also tragic irony that many of the same publications and outlets that would have once made folly of these sorts of things, now they are trying to report it as though this is big news and they were the ones that broke the story, when in fact the majority of the hard work has been done behind the scenes by guys like John who do it with no hope for recompense. Essentially, they do it as a labor of love and also on, I think it's fair to say, a quest for truth. They want to know, well, does the government have information? What do they know? Is there information that is important to us about this topic or would be important if we knew it that is being withheld by our government? And these are, of course, all important questions. And so after John goes on, I jumped on and Jimmy and I kind of looked at the idea of the rise of the UFO investigator and the way that new media and mediums like this, the podcast, are actually helping bring this topic to a much larger audience and also, when done correctly, with a degree of credibility. But right now I want to go to the audio sound bites because we had one gentleman who actually called in with what I think is a fair question. Jimmy actually called it the call of the night. One fella called in from Texas and wanted to know why UFOs really are important. And he acknowledged that he thinks that they are real, but he just wondered, why is it a big deal? And naturally, I had a few thoughts about that. And so with that, we'll head on over to the audio sound bites, and here's how things played out on the airwaves early Sunday morning.
James, you're up next on Coast. Welcome.
All right, thanks. My main question is, while you were talking about UFOs and all that, I'm asking, what does it matter? I believe there are UFOs, but why make such a big deal out of it? What is the purpose?
Yeah, that's a, you know what, James? Call of the night right there. And he's right. And there's something, well, his opinion is right, I should say, in that, Micah, the United States Navy and the Pentagon, like, you know, one of the biggest stories, like in the history of UFOs and ufology, potentially happened this week. But the response was not what I thought it was going to be. And that is with the support of the mass media. I think James brings up a pretty good point, don't you?
I think he does. And I want to get back to that point in just a moment. I should also mention, though, that as you and John Greenwald talked about earlier, maybe the timing of this statement was a little odd because we have this release occurring in the midst of the very timely and important reporting on the coronavirus pandemic. But, you know, that's also a really great way to be able to kind of get a story that is non-topic A, as we would refer to it in media. It's a good way to get it buried. You also have to add to that, though, however, I think that as more and more people become accustomed to seeing regular reporting on the UFO topic, it's kind of becoming a thing, and it will, I think, increasingly with time, become a thing where people are sort of taking an attitude, like James there, where we are sort of saying, you know, well, we are all aware of this topic now, so why is it important? So back to the question, I'd like to try and, you know, illustrate a few reasons why I think that we could say that this is something that's important. Now, we do not know, despite a lot of competing theories, some of which perhaps are stronger or more evidence-based than others, but we do not know what the quote-unquote UFO phenomena represents. For my own part, I think that when we use that term, often we're actually referring to a lot of different things that may range from natural phenomena to experimental aircraft. Drones, of course, have to be taken into consideration in the modern era, but there's also that possibility from time to time that there are things that cannot be readily identified or associated with known technologies, especially those that have been acquired by or presently actually in use by a state actor. And this is what's significant to me about the DOD's statement the other day. We say we can't identify whatever is in these videos. And if you look at what defense experts, and if you look at what, you know, people from all different walks of life, whether it's the sciences or from the military, you know, we're looking at aviation and aerospace professionals. Everyone's looking at these videos and saying it seems highly unlikely that this is some foreign technology, like, and in fact, that's exactly what the DOD says. They don't think it belongs to China. They don't think it belongs to Russia. Of the known technologies that they are believed to possess, this doesn't seem to be a good match for those. And so we are left to have to say, we don't know what this is, but there is not only the potential, of course, always a threat potential, whether or not that is something that has been clearly illustrated or conveyed by this phenomena, and that's the good news. There's no evidence that there is a threat. But nonetheless, if we look at the Advanced Aerospace Threat and Identification Program that we hear about so much these days, that's the reason that the T word is in there. threat assessment. This is part of what the military does with these sorts of operations. And so that must also remain on the table. But on the more positive side of things, I would also say that let's, you know, for instance, look at the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Now, that very well may be something that can account for the phenomena observed in these videos. We haven't proven that yet. And that's why it irks me that I'm seeing people in the media and, you know, popular scientists talking about aliens. That's a bit of a leap in logic. But we need, it's not impossible, it's just we haven't gotten to that point yet. We haven't proven that. But now let's say that we actually do at some point. You know, if it looks like we are closing in on evidence of extraterrestrial visitation to planet Earth, yet again, this answers one of the single greatest questions that humankind has long wondered. This goes all the way back to the philosophical concept of cosmic pluralism. Are we alone in the universe? What would life be like on other planets? If that's what this phenomenon, this technology represents, we may be coming close to answering that question. And I think that's one reason why this is not only important, but maybe one of the single most important issues of our time.
So there you have it. Those are my thoughts on why I think this is indeed such an important subject and why I think we have to pay attention to it and treat it seriously. And this has been the great problem that UFO researchers have faced since this topic really first emerged into the public consciousness after the Second World War. You know, I've argued, and actually this came up during the show. Jimmy and I were talking about this, and I said, some have argued that at the end of the Second World War, some of the technologies that we were using essentially might have been taken like a beacon from extraterrestrials, and that it attracted them to what we were doing down here on Earth. That is a premise that has been put forward by many UFO researchers, and among them the late Stanton Friedman, who often argued that when we started utilizing nuclear weapons, the aliens became interested. That was his working hypothesis. When we dropped nukes at the end of the Second World War, this alerted our intergalactic brethren, watch out, those idiots down there on that mud ball are getting busy. They're building more than just bonfires now. And suddenly we start seeing UFOs because they started taking interest. Now again, I am quoting guys like Stanton Friedman. That was his contention, that these were extraterrestrials observing Earth as we start getting more handy with nuclear weapons. As I think you listeners know, I try to observe the phenomenon without jumping to any conclusion about what it may be, which I do know can be a little frustrating for people at times, but don't mistake that for being wishy-washy. I think it is a bit of a problem that so many people in their research into UFOs lead with the presumption that we know what they are, whereas upon review of the evidence, there is very little that distinctly points to any single source. We have to keep that in mind. And despite all of that, of course, I still acknowledge the likelihood as one potential hypothesis that extraterrestrial technologies may be involved. I absolutely acknowledge that. It's just that I want to try and be open to other possibilities as we proceed, because we're still a good ways from pinning this down, from nailing down a single good theory as to what they may be. So disclaimers aside, it's important to point that out here at the outset of this portion of the discussion, because it's going to be something that comes up many times as we're looking back in history and trying to understand, what are UFOs? Why are they important? And why has it seemed to take so long for people to warm up to the idea that there is a there in the first place? You'd think it would be something we could all agree on by now. Well, it's really important to understand the kinds of social factors that influence people's attitudes toward this topic, and why some who even advocate study of UFOs have argued that we really need to be careful about allowing our ideas and our expectations to get ahead of what science may actually be able to help us discern. And so that brings us back to what Jimmy and I were talking about. I mentioned to him, you hear that idea that many UFO researchers put forward, that essentially the dawn of the atomic age attracted extraterrestrials toward Earth so that they could find out what we're doing. And further evidence of that might be indicated by their appearances over nuclear facilities and things along those lines. But I said, I take a slightly different approach. My argument would be that rather than being attracted to Earth because of the use of nukes, I definitely think the technology played a role
and are becoming aware of the phenomenon around that time, but it was actually the other way around. Rather than them being attracted to us around the end of the Second World War, I think that technologies that we developed during the war essentially enhanced our ability to observe an existing presence. I think that there is some precedent for the idea that there have been unidentified flying objects since prior to World War II, based on a historical review of pre-ufological literature, some of which we've talked about on this program. But if you think about reports of Foo Fighters, in many instances, I do think there probably were atmospheric phenomena that could account for some of those. Other reports of alleged Foo Fighters might have been something different. World War II pilots often described that there were different varieties of them. Some sound a lot like ball lightning to me. Others are a little more difficult to explain simply as natural phenomena. You also have, in Italy, going all the way back, I think, to the 1930s, reports of unidentified flying objects. And in the so-called fascist UFO files, as they are called sometimes, there appear to be even earlier reports of saucers and cigar-shaped aircraft predating the Second World War. You have in Scandinavia during the 1930s the so-called Ghost Flyers episode, which involved planes, but that again was what they were utilizing in the parlance of the day to refer to these objects that were seen over Scandinavia. Anybody's guess what was really going on there? And we could go on down the list of all the different instances of pre-1940s UFO sightings. But the point would be that even during the Second World War, when pilots were describing some of the things that they were seeing, many of those sightings directly precede the use of nuclear weapons. So I've never really seen the whole idea that the minute we drop bombs, the extraterrestrials begin to take notice. I've never necessarily seen that as the most viable hypothesis. But what you cannot deny is that if people were seeing things during the Second World War and immediately afterward, one thing that really starts to kind of bring this into focus, you might say, was the use of radar, a technology that really first comes into use during the Second World War, but which plays a, I think, highly underrated role in the development of human thought in relation to the UFO phenomenon. Because fundamentally what radar does is it allows us to gather instrumental data about things that people say that they are seeing. It's one thing, in other words, for somebody to say, I stepped outside, I saw a light in the sky. Okay, great. People claim that they see things all the time that they may not be able to prove. But when you've got a radar operator at a local airport or a military base saying, actually, we see the object too, and we're painting it on radar, so we also know roughly where it is and what its altitude is, and it appears to be moving, so I can see the light, and we can see it on the radar. That, I would argue, may be one of the most significant developments in relation to reports of unidentified flying objects. And yet, I feel that the significance of the development of radar technology and their use in assisting with the confirmation of visual UFO sightings, I'm actually surprised that that isn't recognized more often than it is. But I think that the corollary for that would essentially be what we are now seeing the DOD confirming with the official release of their UFO videos. Indistinct though those videos may be, what we now have is a new kind of technology that, in addition to tracking them at a distance on radar, even if they are moving so quickly that most cameras wouldn't be able to detect them, now we also have technology, specifically the Raytheon AtFLIR forward targeting pod systems being utilized by the Navy fighter jets, which have managed to film these objects. Yeah, now we actually do have a camera component. But I saw, and I think I can name him here, I didn't name him on Coast to Coast AM, but it was Neil deGrasse Tyson who I saw tweeting recently that if these videos are the best we have as far as proof of aliens, then we have a whole lot of work to do. Now, guys, you know, I respect Neil deGrasse Tyson. I do. I like him. But I've got to take issue with our fine man of science here because, first, who ever said they were aliens? Okay, I get it. A lot of people have. But really, those who are trying to maintain scientific objectivity have said there is something in those videos. Our government cannot identify them. Yes, these appear to be the quote-unquote UFOs we've been talking about now for decades, but that does not mean proof of aliens. So I fundamentally reject Mr. Tyson's approach when he says, if this is what you call proof of aliens, we've got a lot of work to do. This is proof of something. And it may yet be still too early to say aliens. But to leap to that conclusion or to criticize the evidence based upon that presupposition isn't helping us understand what we're actually seeing in those videos. And so for my own part, respect Mr. Tyson though I do, I really disagree with his fundamental approach. But I'll give him this. It was a tweet, okay? Even though I expect he'd say something very similar even if he were talking on a stage in front of an audience. It was a tweet, so maybe character limits taken into consideration. Maybe there were limitations. I'd love for him to elaborate a little on this, but my guess is probably that, like many scientists do, he too is leading with certain presuppositions rather than really looking at the data only for what it is. And so my fundamental argument right now is I think we have a lot of anecdotal data that shows that however few in numbers the quote-unquote good cases may be. After all, past studies do indicate that around maybe 95% of all UFO reports can be easily explained, or at very least conventional explanations can be found. But nonetheless, we still have those few outliers, and even the famous University of Colorado project, otherwise known as the Condon Report, it came to the same determination as we're going to look at here in just a bit, that there are some reports that remain unexplained, and those, interestingly, you guessed it, they involved radar visual encounters. But at that time, with that technology at our disposal, useful though it was, it did not help us form a clear picture. And I think that that is one reason, among a few others, that the University of Colorado UFO project could not completely dismiss UFOs as being bunk, even though many of those who were involved with the project took that attitude nonetheless, as did the media. They couldn't really completely dismiss the subject, but they essentially resolved that we cannot prove that there is much of a phenomena here, even if we can all agree that some of the incidents that we studied cannot be easily explained. They remain, in other words, unidentified. But what does that really mean? Well, we don't know. And frankly, we don't think that funneling taxpayer dollars into studying these things anymore is necessarily going to be helpful right now. More importantly, science isn't gaining anything from putting money behind UFO studies. So let's put it on hold for now. And maybe in the future we can revisit this problem if we feel it's warranted, when we have better technology at our disposal. And so that's one of the reasons I think that the videos that we're seeing are so important. People have argued they don't prove that aliens are visiting. Of course they don't. But to be making that argument is kind of missing the point. What we have now is new technology like radar did many decades ago, which is helping to broaden human awareness of phenomena occurring on this planet. Consider this one for a second, and I highly doubt this will be the case, but what if whatever is in those videos actually turns out to be some very rare variety of natural phenomena? Again, I consider that to be probably the least likely conclusion, if any are yet to be made about these videos, but nonetheless, the point I'm making is we now have a new kind of technology, or we are utilizing new kinds of systems of technology that are like radar once did, broadening our awareness of things happening in the world. But when you add to that the fact that with our broadened awareness, the things that we are observing appear to correlate with existing data, and that of course being UFO sightings that have occurred over time, there is a strong case to be made, in my mind, that there is a phenomena here, and one very worthy of studying, and one that now, perhaps, we are better equipped to study than we have been in years past. So when the Condon Committee, at the end of their study, said, we don't close the book on UFOs, we just say that maybe we should wait a few years until we have a reason to study these things, my argument would be maybe now we not only have a good reason based on the technology, but we're better equipped to do that study. And that, my friends, brings us to the fundamental question. Why, really, did we ever look at UFOs as being something that shouldn't be reported on, Why have UFOs been dismissed as being only the kinds of things that people with mental health issues will claim that they have seen or experienced? Where did this so-called ridicule factor come into play? When we come back after this, I want to go back in time to the early days of UFOs, and then I want to kind of hone in on 1966, one of 2 years in history where there was a real peak in UFO sightings. And this, of course, leads to the University of Colorado UFO Project. We'll see how the media reported on all of this when we return, right here on the Micah Hanks program. From the high mountains of Appalachia, welcome back, everybody. It is the Micah Hanks program, keeping you company like we always do. And of course, a lot of you guys are keeping me company down here in the dark heart of the hollow earth by joining our ranks. And that, of course, means you are becoming ex-subscribers. If you aren't already an ex-subscriber, it's easy to do. Just head over to MicahHanks.com/podcast. And right there in the upper right-hand corner of the page, you will see where you can become an ex-subscriber. Although, you can also find that at our legacy page, GraylianReport.com/X. All roads lead to the bunker. And so for just $7 a month, you can get access to additional podcasts from yours truly, and of course the monthly edition that we add called Enigmas. And I think that you guys will definitely enjoy this month's edition of Enigmas that we just dropped. It looks at some of the supernatural influences behind rock and roll. That's a subject that I've long been fascinated with. Everything from Robert Johnson and the idea of going down to the crossroads to Led Zeppelin and black magic, yeah, it's all in there. So that's something for subscribers to look forward to. But now getting back on topic with UFOs right now, one reason that I've had this on my mind recently, in addition to some of the developments of the last few days, going on coast on Saturday night, not only talking with Jimmy about that, but also taking calls from people around the country and getting their perspectives. Tim McMillan, our intrepid reporter and friend of the program, he and I had been talking recently, and he too has been looking back at the late 1960s and the cultural impact that the Condon Report had on the study of this topic. And I think as we proceed, it's important to remember that although at various times UFOs have been taken more seriously and less seriously, and that attitudes toward them have changed, UFOs have never really been a resoundingly important topic, especially in the scientific community. Despite this, there have been scientists, however, who have argued that they should be studied. But I don't think that UFOs have ever really become a mainstream topic, and it's this up and down kind of shifting of attitudes that occurs periodically that should be kept in mind. UFOs appear on the scene and are first really widely recognized, we might argue, in 1947. Technology assists with this. And then, for the next couple of decades, a controversy ensues. There's a lot of back and forth. And eventually things come to a head in 1969. And I want to mostly focus on the period between 1966 and 1969, where we had not only a lot of UFO sightings being reported. In fact, according to the figures gathered by NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomenon, and U.S. Air Force figures, 1966 was the second best year for UFO sightings behind 1952, which many call, historically speaking, the year of the UFO. And so in just a bit, we're going to look at 1966 to 1969, the public interest that was building during this period, the debate that was ongoing between science, and what essentially brought a resolution to the entire thing, and one which many did not agree with, and which resulted largely in dismissal of the UFO subject for decades by most of the popular press. But the idea of this ridicule factor in relation to the media, broadly speaking, but really I think it's also fair to say that one leading American newspaper, the New York Times, plays a very significant role in the history of shifting attitudes toward the UFO subject. Most recently, we've seen that beginning in 2017 with the article by Cooper, Blumenthal, and Kane, which brought to public attention the idea of the ATIP program, the Pentagon's UFO study group. But if we go all the way back to the beginning, in the really early days, when the UFOs first appear on the cultural landscape right after the war, some have argued that the New York Times played a significant role that early on in terms of steering public attitudes in relation to the UFO phenomenon. And that very point was first brought to my attention by researcher Peter Robbins, who I spoke with in 2013. Going way back into the archives of the early days of this show, my brother and I sat down and had spoken with Peter Robbins the first time he ever did an interview with me. And this is exactly what he argued, that going and sitting back in the old days in the reading room there at the New York Times and poring through their archives, which you couldn't do with search engines back in those days. I mean, that was really hard work back then. And Peter went and did it. But he said, you see distinctly the way that the New York Times played a significant role in the shaping of public attitudes in relation to the UFO topic. I want to go to the audio now, where Peter explains this process and also the patterns that he began to see as he goes back through the Times archives looking for articles on UFOs, the tone that they had taken, and the way that the public seems to respond to the presentation of those articles in print.
This is, again, in the late 80s. It's before the internet's available to us and all that stuff. And I visited the New York Times newspaper morgue. I lived in Manhattan most of my life. And at the time, it was very Dickensian. You worked out of huge 19th century style ledgers, and all the topics were cross-referenced. And I looked under every variation I could think of, from aerial discs to unidentified phenomena, flying saucers, of course, spaceships. Learned also, by the way, that in 1947, the words spaceship and extraterrestrial didn't exist. Each one was only used as separate words, extraterrestrial and spaceship. It was some time after that they merged. But I ended up finding, I don't know, 150 or more articles. And then working with the combination state-of-the-art analog microfiche Xerox machines, I laboriously printed these things out, put them in order, and that file stayed dormant for years. Not that long ago, several years ago, I went back, and all of it now is, of course, digitally available and accessible from any computer, although I decided to do it right there in the main branch New York City Public Library, and completed my collection, so to say, and have kept it up to date. I then put all the articles in order and realized what I wanted to do was see if I could deduce a pattern, whether it was in a response to a letter to the editor, to a brief article, an editorial, a major article, or a series of articles like the Washington overflights of 1952. And believe it or not, there were days that the New York Times had five pieces in one newspaper about that case, day after day. It was quite phenomenal.
Wow.
The lady doth protest too much. Shakespeare is always right. But living out of the box and being an artist, I thought about how best to find this pattern. And I thought, okay, let's just do it. And I literally read these 200 or so articles in a row and then did it again and then did it again. And I think on the fifth go at about 2 a.m. in a somewhat altered state with out the necessity of any inebriates, I saw it. It was as clear as it could be. It was basically in the initial report. It was a serious report, whether it was a sentence or a paragraph. And then we moved into the careful pat on the head. Let me explain it to you, and I'll say it slowly so you don't get confused. Everybody's upset with the Soviet threat, and we still got war jitters in quotes. It's a possibility of mass hallucinations. It could be one of our new, you know, rockets that we're testing. Everybody's on edge, but of course it can't be one of those Orson Welles Martian spaceships. So let's all lighten the heck up. And then they trot out the authorities to quell any anxiety you may have left, often unnamed and almost always psychologists or astronomers who resent the hell out of this subject as a rule because they don't want to get associated with something that we all know is silly. And the Times didn't even report on the Kenneth Arnold sightings of June 24th, 1947, nor did they carry the press that so many newspapers around this country and the world did of the first day of Roswell reports. They picked it up the second day when poor Jesse Marcel was forced to go through the ultimate humiliation, posing with those pieces of a Mogul weather balloon, that poor man. And it took off from there. I continued to delve into the history of the Times, the fact that at that time in America, there were newspapers, there were a few news magazines, and there was the radio, and the New York Times led the pack. Now, I also, through some amazing quirk, in the old Arcturus Book Service, rest in peace, Bob Girard, one of the great bookmen of all time, I picked up a bound copy of a brilliant PhD thesis on local UFO reporting, and it cited ever so many segments from local newspapers around the United States who almost always took the subject seriously, completely opposite their big brothers in the major cities. And what began to occur to me was that something caused, or the editorial staff at the Times, to make a decision that first week of July, or possibly even earlier, 1947, that they would simply cover this, and it turns out about 98% of the time, and it may be 99, in a very cavalier, sarcastic, non-serious manner. I couldn't put it down. And although I can't prove it, and if my life depended on it, I could not trot out any evidence. But I am convinced, based on having read the memoirs of Harry Truman, books of his letters, the guy fascinated me as an everyman thrust into history, that Truman, who, of course, was the president at the time of the birth of the modern age of UFOs, who, whether or not one feels that all of the so-called Majestic 12 documentation is authentic, or people like me who feel that much of it may be very, very clever disinformation. It's certainly not done in somebody's basement, unless it's somebody's basement in Washington or Virginia, that a decision was made either at the presidential level or to preserve plausible deniability on the part of the president with key advisors who may well and very likely were members of MJ-12, that there was a need to make contact with the leaders in the media. And this would be Hearst, the Copley Syndicate newspapers, several hundred newspapers coming out of Boston, the New York Times, of course, David Sarnoff, who was the head of NBC. And it could have gone one of several ways, either that we are very concerned in the summer of 47 with the Soviets and us beginning to draw the lines, and it's looked like there's another possibility of war. It was that summer that the idea of a Cold War actually came into play. And to digress for 30 seconds, the July issue of Foreign Affairs, a very important publication, which is still in print, of course, carried an article called On Containment, written by a young, completely unknown political scientist, a brilliant one, by the way, under the pseudonym of X. And it laid out a theory for dealing with the Soviets to avoid a shooting or hot war by essentially freezing our borders with them at what we then began to call the Iron Curtain, a phrase not in today's lexicon. And in fact, that man, George Kennan, went on to become one of the most influential political advisors of the century. I believe he advised, believe it or not, nine United States presidents. He lived to be a little over 100 years old. And most trained American historians, if they are pressed to give a date to the beginning of the Cold War, it is July 1947. Now, this is a coincidence, but one that was brilliantly played upon over the next 45 years for any serious student of ufology and post-war history, where you see, and I think it's best gleaned in the brilliant work of Richard Dolan and UFOs in the National Security State, Part 1 and Part 2, where UFO events were sometimes played as Cold War events. And Cold War events were sometimes used as a cover for a serious UFO incident. And I genuinely feel, in fact, I'm convinced that key members of the Truman staff compelled, asked, based on the patriotism of these very powerful individuals to play along, either because we are dealing with a serious situation here and we don't need this nonsensical distraction, whatever it is, it's of no importance, so don't even give it any serious attention, or taking some of these very powerful Americans into at least the beginnings of their confidence in saying there is something to this. We're working on trying to figure it out. And until we do, the last thing we need is even the possibility of panic. You know, we're literally a year and a half here after beating the Nazis and making the world free for democracy. And I am as sure as I can be that that is how things kicked in. Now, once the Times started to cover it this way, the other majors followed. And imagine if you were an editor and you simply put out a memo to your reporters that these stories are to be covered in this manner. What reporter, even one with their teeth into a genuinely compelling, witnessed, documented, evidence-rich UFO story is going to want to risk their career by going against the orders of, you know, their publisher, editor, and what they observed was the overwhelming trend of reportage. So that's the short of it. Out of that came a very long paper and two wonderful databases where I contrast on a very strict timeline every one of these articles with hundreds of declassified, absolutely gilt-edged, unquestioned, previously secret or, you know, classified documents. And it is a damning picture and a fascinating one.
So those were the findings of Peter Robbins. And again, looking at those early days of reporting on the UFO topic and how from the outset there had been something of a attitude of dismissal. And Peter has really done some fantastic work in that regard. Now, I want to jump ahead a few years because, as I'd mentioned before, we went to the audio soundbite there with Peter, who lays out the case for us that there was significant steering of the narrative. Peter also interprets that as being possibly in relation to government activities. In other words, the idea of media being utilized for propaganda efforts. One of the most notable areas where there is historical precedent for this involves what is known as Project Mockingbird. But again, the general idea that major mainstream news organizations and publications might be used in the furtherance of the objectives of the U.S. government at times, it's not a crazy idea, and it is one for which there is some historical precedent. And that's Peter's interpretation of what's happening with the early reporting carried out by the New York Times. There's also the possibility that there is just a credibility factor at play here. In other words, that a publication like the New York Times, which, putting all political biases aside, please understand, I am merely looking at them as being a significant source for news in the United States and an industry leader and therefore one of the most influential publications, influential enough that they're actually able to, whether directly or indirectly, encourage other smaller media outlets, as Peter touched on, to sort of follow suit in the way that they cover stories and the tone that they take with certain topics. That is one of the big reasons why the New York Times should be focused on in relation to all of this, and one needs no further proof of that publication's efficacy in bringing attention to subjects like UFOs if they want to, for good or for ill, than the quote-unquote big article from 2017. But of course, as we're seeing, there is a much longer history of that publication's involvement in reporting on this topic, and either through dismissal or through, at times, reporting on legitimate aspects of it, their ability to steer public perception of the phenomenon as a result. And so when we come back, I want to go back in time to 1966, where sightings were on the rise, scientists were fighting about what UFOs are or whether there was even anything to study, and as pressure was building, things were very quickly coming to a head for what would be one of the most important developments in UFO history. We will examine that when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. I'm Micah Hanks. March 26th, 1966, a day that would go down in infamy. With the following headline, flying objects are called gas. Air Force expert points to Michigan sightings being made above swamps. Yeah, one of those notable moments in UFO history where this guy comes out, apparently a skeptic, and says, what you think you saw hovering over the swamp, that was merely gas. This is a natural phenomenon. These are not extraterrestrial visitors. Funny that the guy who said that would eventually end up becoming one of the leading advocates in the sciences for the serious study of UFOs. That, of course, had been J. Allen Hynek. And the New York Times reporting on the fact that he appeared in Detroit arguing that sightings of UFOs that had occurred recently over that state were in fact likely to have been swamp gas. And Hynek, speaking before the press, essentially reasoned that here we had this dismal swamp and people saying they saw a light hovering over it. Helicopters aren't going to hover over a swamp. Extraterrestrial visitors probably have far more interesting things that they would be going and looking at. People said that they saw this light out there over the swamp, that occasionally it sort of moved around. But the best explanation in this case as to why a light would appear over a swamp and stay there for a long time is probably gases that are produced as a result of decomposition and are occasionally seen over swamps. They're known by many names, but swamp gas is one of them. Will-o'-the-wisp happens to be another. But this explanation didn't sit well with a lot of people. The New York Times reporting, Dr. Hynek dismissed pictures of another phenomenon he said were taken on March 17th near Milan, Michigan. The consultant said that the photographs were without any question only time exposures of a rising moon and the planet Venus. Ah, we see. Swamp gas. Rising moon, the planet Venus. Hynek noted there had been a flood of other reports from that area, and he said, I could not possibly have had the time to investigate all of these. They were of little scientific significance, he added, because there were no substantial groups of witnesses who agreed on what they had seen. I don't think Hynek would ever quite live that down, that he had argued that swamp gas might account for some UFO sightings, and actually, I might say that in that instance, he very well could have been correct. I don't think he was necessarily off base by arguing, hey, there may be a natural explanation, at least in this case. But he would catch flack for years from the UFO community for making such a supposition. And that's why I think, in part, Hynek is such an interesting character Here is the man of science, once a skeptic, who comes around to the idea that maybe there really is something more to this, but of course was ridiculed throughout his career for making a skeptical argument of that magnitude. Not everybody agreed. And we also have the following report that appeared in the New York Times on March 27th, 1966, where they reported on the fact that Gerald Ford decided to toss his weight behind the saucer investigations, calling for congressional hearings on this and saying that the people of Michigan are very concerned. We need to take this seriously. He also, rather humorously, noted that it must have been a slow day for his commentary on UFOs to be getting the kind of attention that it did, but nonetheless, it had a pretty profound effect. And so by early April, we had hearings before the House Armed Services Committee. And here again, the New York Times reporting that on April 5th, the Secretary of the Air Force assured a congressional committee today there was no evidence that the Earth ever had been visited by strangers from outer space. Dr. Harold Brown, pictured there by the New York Times, addressing Congress, telling the House Armed Services Committee that, quote, the Air Force has an open mind and would continue to investigate all reports, but they were saying, sorry guys, there just isn't any evidence for visitations from space. That wasn't a view that was held by everybody, of course, though, because on May the 24th, 1966, the Times also featured the following headline, visits from space are called possible by airlines official, and they cite Knut Hammarskjöld, who at that time had just become the new director general of the International Air Transport Association. And he said, I believe in these things, referring to flying saucers. Of course, it is necessary to sift and sort all the information and to be as realistic as possible. Firstly, though, he says, is it really that unlikely that there exist civilizations outside our planet which are more developed, both technically and mentally, than we are? Secondly, are these space neighbors of ours getting more interested in what we are doing as our own technical abilities develop? Now, part of what makes that particular article interesting to me is the fact that UFOs hadn't even really been the main focus of that appearance by the new director. He just happened to bring them up. Later in the article, they talk about some of the other less exciting and sensational things that he had had to say that day, but the fact that he brings up flying saucers and says, you know, I believe in these things and science should be studying them. That, of course, ended up being what was newsworthy. And it's really interesting, as we are making our way through 1966, just to see how much reporting was appearing in the New York Times and in the Associated Press and other publications in relation to this. Consider the July 15th, 1966 New York Times headline, Air Force to Press Study of Unidentified Objects. And this marks a turning point because, as they report here, the Air Force intends to make contracts with universities to provide scientific teams to investigate promptly and in-depth sightings of unidentified flying objects. This, of course, is foreshadowing what was to come with the University of Colorado UFO project, although early on, both the coordinators of that project, Edward U. Condon and his committee, and the Air Force had envisioned that when UFO sightings occurred, there would actually be a team that could be dispatched to go and investigate. That isn't what the Condon Committee ended up doing. But in the early days, that certainly had been the general idea. The Times going on to report here, the Air Force said today that no schools had been chosen and the number to be used in the investigations was still indefinite. A scientific advisory board recommended last March that this course of action be followed by the Air Force, which has pledged to strengthen studies of reports it receives on such objects. Does that sound familiar at all? Think within just the last couple of years, we have the Navy and the Air Force saying they're going to up the game, Politico, Washington Post, New York Times, everybody reporting on the fact that the Navy says we are going to take these sightings seriously and we are going to update our procedures for reporting and invite our pilots to let us know the kinds of things they're seeing. Nothing new under the sun, ladies and gents. Now, we skip ahead to September 18th, 1966, with a very interesting article titled Scientists Accused on Flying Saucers. The article reads, an Illinois astronomer has criticized what he calls the failure to investigate persistent reports of unidentified flying objects despite the fact that sightings of many flying saucers remain unexplained. Who do you think this man would be? This champion who would come forth and criticize the scientific community for downplaying flying saucers? Dr. J. Allen Hynek, a chairman of Northwestern University's Department of Astronomy and a consultant to the Air Force on the subject, cited what he called the, quote, persistent and disturbing phenomenon. Now think about that. As recently, going back in time here, as March 1966, it had been Hynek who had been saying that maybe swamp gas could account for some of these sightings. And within just a few months, he's also the one making headlines for criticizing the scientific community's downplaying of the UFO issue. Now, I want to point out that I am not criticizing the late J. Allen Hynek. If anything, I'm actually trying to showcase the fact that when he felt it was warranted, he was more than happy to be skeptical, and always tried to be. But he also felt that rather than skepticism, there was a cynical kind of doubt that prevailed among many in the scientific community, and he spoke out within just months of making the immortal statements about swamp gas. He spoke out and was making headlines with what appeared to many to be a contrarian sort of approach. Well, didn't you say that these things were swamp gas before? And now you're saying science needs to look at them and you're criticizing your colleagues who don't? But this is why I think Hynek was such a good scientist, because he didn't believe every UFO sighting, but he recognized nonetheless that however few might be credible incidents involving unidentified objects, that alone warranted scientific study. Guys, let's proceed with caution. Let's continue to look for explanations when we can find them, but let's at least study the problem. He wasn't, in other words, this binary kind of thinker like many were, and many still are today. And that sort of binary thinking is what informs those who would argue, well, either we're talking about alien spacecraft from Zeta to Reticuli, or there is nothing to see at all. To me, those kind of simplified arguments simply don't do this subject any justice. And yet, even today, so many decades later, they continue to prevail. October 8th, 1966, the following month, we have three aides selected in the saucer inquiry as the U.S. Air Force is picking out what academic institutions they want to have involved in their UFO study. Walter Sullivan reporting that Dr. Edward U. Condon of the University of Colorado will end up being selected for the job. They say he will head the new Air Force-sponsored program for checking flying saucer reports. This announced yesterday, with the appointment of three top aides and discussing how proposed to go about his assignment. Now, I want to point out, there's something really interesting in this little article. And yes, it requires going back through the archives, which fortunately, now one can subscribe to the New York Times as I do, and they can go back through and utilize their search engines to find these articles. It's much easier for guys like me to do this than it was when poor Peter Robbins had to go and sit down there and sift through those documents, which is one more reason I respect him and his work so dang much. You know, doing this back in the day before it was easy to do. But even for me doing it today, it still requires a lot of time and a lot of reading. So I'm curating years of UFO reports for you within the short scope of a single podcast. And here's one of the real big takeaways from some of this early reporting on the Condon Committee, as it became known. They note here, the university has signed a $313,000 contract with the Air Force for a 15-month study of flying saucers. The contract may then be renewed. But they note here, it is designed to blunt charges that the government has ignored unidentified flying objects or that it has concealed what it knows on the subject. Now, think about that for a moment. That's a really interesting thing for the New York Times to have been reporting in autumn of 1966. Before this study is even underway, we're talking about a scientific study, right? We're trying to look at UFOs scientifically. And yet they say that the aims of the study were actually to blunt charges that the government has ignored unidentified flying objects or that it has concealed what it knows on the subject. I get it. We want the public to know that we're taking it seriously. But really, do we need to spend $313,000 in 1966 U.S. dollars to convince or try to convince the public that we are taking this subject seriously and we're not hiding information from the public? Kind of sad that that was the price tag, And yet, these were apparently the objectives. These were the aims that were reported from the outset. To hell with studying this scientifically and trying to understand the phenomena, let's just make sure that people know we aren't hiding anything. And apparently, they didn't really succeed in convincing anybody of that either, did they? October 21st, 1966, physicist scores saucer status, says science is delinquent in research into reports. This time citing a different man of science who argued that flying saucers should be taken seriously, Dr. James E. McDonald, who said in an interview that, quote, science had been delinquent in dismissing so-called flying saucers with too few attempts to find physical or psychological explanations. The Times reported here that he said that 18 years of administrative foul-up by the Air Force, which is charged with investigating aerial phenomena, and deliberate government debunking of UFO sightings had frightened away scientists and left needless confusion in the public's mind. Now, deliberate government debunking of UFOs, why would they have done that? If the government thought there might be a there, in other words, would they deliberately debunk cases regardless of that for some other reason? Well, yes, they certainly would. And later in the same article, they actually note that, quote, while his investigations, Dr. McDonald, that is, have convinced him there is no attempt to cover up a super secret, he says he found evidence in Air Force documents that the Central Intelligence Agency in 1953 asked the Air Force to debunk saucer reports because they were clogging vital military reporting channels and demanding too much time of investigators. Now, if you recall when we had Dr. Bruce Maccabee on the show, Maccabee pointed that out. That was one of the reasons why a dismissive attitude had been taken by government. They wanted to debunk these cases to convey to the public, guys, there's nothing to see here, because they didn't want every Tom, Dick, and Harry reporting back to the government on everything that they saw that they thought might be a flying saucer, which thereby would potentially clog communication and reporting channels. But even more importantly, and this is where things get complex in the geopolitical scope of things, if there were groups or organizations with sympathies toward communism or toward Russia, even worse, if these organizations were actually working in collusion with Soviet intelligence, and their actual intention was to clog those communication channels so as to help provide a sort of cover for Soviet operations, that too became a serious concern for intelligence agencies. And so I think it really should be pointed out, many have said the government knows what's going on with UFOs, and they're covering it up. That is the reason why the government takes a dismissive attitude. It is merely a smokescreen to hide what they know. Well, actually, there is some historical precedent, yet again, for intelligence agencies in the U.S. government taking a dismissive attitude toward UFOs and even actively encouraging debunking by investigative organizations like the U.S. Air Force's Project Blue Book. The reason, though, is a little different from covering up what they actually know. Rather, they were concerned about how people might misuse UFO reporting, or more importantly, how that might benefit foreign actors. And so Dr. McDonald pointed that out, who had been a longtime advocate, and who would remain one up until the time of his death, for the serious scientific study of UFOs. And Dr. McDonald had also at times been a bit of a critic of J. Allen Hynek, as Hynek actually wrote in his book, The Hynek UFO Report. In November of 1966, we also have the headline, Study of Saucers Gains Acceptance. Condon says many seek to aid the University of Colorado work. Things were proceeding as planned, and Condon, who had actually, just prior to that, had run for university regent as a Democrat and lost, told the New York Times, I was, quote, campaigning like mad through October and the hell with flying saucers. So he hadn't been very interested in them up until losing that election, at which time he was able to shift his attention full-time, and the study was beginning to gain some acceptance. Now, as I had mentioned, 1966 was a pretty big year for UFOs, not just because of all these developments that were percolating. There were also a lot of sightings going on that year, and on February 15th of 1967, the New York Times reported that sightings of unidentified flying objects increased sharply in 1966, and that according to Major Hector Quintanilla, who at that time was the director of Project Blue Book. They reported, but whatever the sightings were, the Air Force contended they offered no threat to national security and did not come from outer space. A total of 1,060 sightings were submitted to the Air Force during 1966, the second highest total since Blue Book began keeping records 20 years ago. The annual average is 555. The record high, of course, of 1,501 was set in 1952. Quintanilla also told the New York Times that of the 11,107 sightings that had occurred since 1947, just 676 remain in the unidentified category. Hey, that's still a pretty significant number, too. Another interesting phenomena that I want to point out, apart from UFOs themselves and general prevalence of reporting on them during the years between 1966 and 1969, had been the length of articles. Again, when we look at the big stories since 2017 that have appeared in publications like the New York Times, Politico, the Washington Post, and others, many would and actually have said, that is unprecedented. You never see UFOs getting this kind of attention. But on April 16th, 1967, Walter Sullivan, who regularly covered UFOs when they appeared in print in the New York Times, did an article in the science section of the Times titled On the Trail of the UFO, which was a very lengthy article that breaks down a lot of the ideas about everything from actual eyewitness accounts to possible explanations for what they might be. And then finally, the concern that had begun to appear around that time that the so-called Condon Committee and its report might end up being a whitewash. I want to quote here from Walter Sullivan's 1967 article. The fact, he says, that the Air Force is financing Dr. Condon's inquiry has led some of those who take the reports seriously to prophesy that his report would be a whitewash. There are UFO believers on the campus at Boulder, as there are in other such communities, said Dr. Condon, who's been asked at student gatherings whether his mind was not closed on the subject. He has vehemently denied this, arguing that the mind of a scientist should not be closed to anything. Although, as we will hear a little later, people's concerns about the true objectivity of Edward Condon and those on his committee was perhaps warranted. More on that a little later, but first I want to mention the fact that in November of 1967, seemingly in response to all of the news coming out of the United States about scientists and the debate over UFOs, we have the following headline. Soviet study of UFOs is reportedly underway. That's right, the Soviet government, they said, has set up a special commission to investigate reports in this country of unidentified flying objects, informed sources reported today. The following day, a little more goes to print about this. They note here that a Soviet astronomer has called for joint effort of all the scientists of the world to determine the nature of unidentified flying objects. Not just a U.S. study, not just a Soviet study. The statement actually that was made by Felix Ziegel of the Moscow Aviation Institute had to do with not only the profound respect he had for the work of some American scientists, presumably he was talking about Dr. James McDonald and also J. Allen Hynek, but he further stated that we are with good reason trying to attract the attention of America's scientific public to the UFO problem. He went on to say, unfortunately, certain scientists both in the Soviet Union and in the United States deny the very existence of the problem instead of helping to solve it. And there were some interesting descriptions that appeared in the Times article about the Russian perspective on UFOs, and more importantly, the actual descriptions of the objects seen over the Soviet Union at that time. I want to look at a few of those here. A luminous orange-colored crescent flying with its outward bend forward. Its surface is only a little duller than that of the moon. That was one description. They said that the horns of the crescent throw out jets, sometimes with sparks. The outer contour of the crescent is sharp, and the inner contour blurred and wavy. A bright flaming disc preceded by a crescent is sometimes observed, and that description to me actually sounds reminiscent of an observation of a landed UFO that occurred during an incident that occurred around that time at Minot Air Force Base. They report here that sometimes the crescent is preceded and flanked by what looks like first magnitude stars that keep at a constant distance from the crescent. In some cases, Professor Ziegel reported that the crescent dwindled into a disc or a dot, such an object sighted in the Ukraine last September. was reported to have executed a maneuver when approached by a plane. The scientist cautioned, however, that this report certainly needs verification. Astronomers in Kazan, according to Professor Ziegel, set the diameter of the crescents they observed at 500 to 600 meters, that is, 1,640 to 1,840 feet, and their speed at about 5 kilometers a second. So here again that question of whether or not astronomers see UFOs. In this instance, apparently they did, and they also had some pretty unique estimates about their size and also their speed. And so that finishes up 1967. When we return, it will be an all-new year. And as funding for the University of Colorado UFO Project continues to be raised, we'll hear about the continuing efforts by scientists both to look at the subject and what ultimately would end up happening when they did right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back as we're rounding out our conversation about UFOs, shifting scientific attitudes, and the role that the media plays in this. Again, I feel that one cannot overlook the significance that a publication like the New York Times plays in this as an industry leader, and we need look no further than 2017 for direct recent evidence of that, but again, this has been an evolving story for decades now. Flying saucer study to get $183,155 more dollars for the project. That, of course, leading up to the eventual Condon Committee's report on UFOs. Meanwhile, we also have this following headline that's kind of fun out of Moscow. And if you notice, by the way, I'm giving you this chronological overview, starting with Hynek saying swamp gas, and leading up to the publication of the Condon Committee report, note the short distance between appearances of articles in the New York Times that's occurring during this period. We think it's a big deal when every few months, or maybe every couple of years, there's a significant article about UFOs these days. Back then, it was quite common every few weeks, or at least every few months, for the New York Times to feature significant reporting on this topic. Between 1966, when there were so many sightings occurring, and 1969, when Ed Condon and his crew were tasked with actually looking at the subject. But we have this report here from February 18th. It's kind of fun, out of Moscow. Flying saucers are just a capitalist plot to keep the minds of workers off the hard lives they lead, according to a Soviet science expert. When it becomes necessary to distract the reader from tough problems, Western leaders have three ready sensations which never fail: flying saucers, the Loch Ness Monster, and the abominable snowman. This according to science columnist V. Leostiberg in the Daily Moskovy Komsomolets. Well, if that were indeed the case, you'd think we'd be seeing a whole lot more reports of the Loch Ness Monster and abominable snowmen in addition to UFO sightings during this pandemic, huh? Now, while headlines like that were underway, we had the University of Colorado UFO study underway. And no, they weren't being dispatched to study active UFO reports. The Condon Committee essentially was taking a look by that time at what the Air Force had already gathered. And on May the 1st, 1968, the Times reports that Colorado University ends its saucer study but does not disclose results. The plan had been, because of the concerns we mentioned earlier about this whitewash, the plan had been that once they concluded their study, they were going to pass what they had along to the National Academy of the Sciences for an independent review of the study. But in the May 1st, 1968 article in the Times, there are some interesting points that are made. They note here, and it's Everett Clark who had been the writer, Dr. Condon's statements come amidst a controversy between himself and Look magazine over an article it printed calling the project the, quote, flying saucer fiasco. The completion of the field investigations and the controversy were not related, the physicist said. Now, a couple of points on the Look magazine article that's referenced right there. This was written by John G. Fuller, who was a popular author who wrote a lot about UFOs. But he raised some, I think, legitimate concerns about the objectivity of the Condon Committee in the article that he wrote, which I'll quote a little from here. From Look magazine, he wrote, "A strange series of incidents in the University of Colorado Unidentified Flying Objects study has led to a near mutiny by several of the staff scientists, the dismissal of two PhDs on the staff, and the resignation of the project's administrative assistant. The study, announced as a totally objective scientific investigation of one of the most puzzling phenomena of modern times, has already cost the taxpayer over $500,000. Later in the article, Fuller discusses James McDonald, the scientist we mentioned earlier, and notes that, quote, "From the beginning, the relationship between Dr. McDonald and Robert Lowe, the project coordinator for the Colorado Project, was abrasive. Lowe," he said, "who speaks softly, smoothly, and guardedly, contrasts sharply with McDonald, who is intense and bluntly articulate. The relationship between the Colorado group and NICAP was especially important. NICAP was large and well-organized and could supply information on UFO sightings on a nationwide scale. NICAP hoped that the Colorado group would retain its scientific objectivity by concentrating on the estimated 10% of high-credibility cases, such as those Dr. McDonald was investigating. The first major turbulence in the new project came early in February 1967. Condon, burdened by heavy responsibilities in many public and educational projects, could not spend much time in the project offices." Remember, he had been running for a particular office and ended up not actually being elected. "So Robert Lowe assumed the responsibilities for most of the decision-making. But," they say, "on January 25th, Condon, known for his breezy, anecdotal style, spoke before a scientific fraternity, and the Elmira, New York Star-Gazette reported, quote, 'Unidentified flying objects are not the business of the Air Force,' Dr. Edward U. Condon said here Wednesday night. Dr. Condon left no doubt as to his personal sentiments on the matter. 'It is my inclination right now to recommend that the government get out of this business. My attitude right now is that there's nothing to it.' With a smile, he added, 'But I'm not supposed to reach a conclusion for another year.'" Well, good to know you hadn't there, Bobby. Fuller went on to say the story also quoted Condon as saying, quote, "What we're always reduced to is interviewing persons who claim they've had some kind of experience. I don't know of any cases where the phenomenon was still there after the person reports it, and it seems odd, but these people always seem to wait until they get home before they report what they saw." Well, could that have had anything to do with the fact that there weren't cell phones back in those days? Which is an easy argument, admittedly, to make today, in hindsight. But back then, surely Dr. Condon would have had to have known that many people are going to go home and make a phone call to report what they have seen. Some may go directly to police. Some may use a payphone, sure. And don't forget, of course, that in many instances, people are actually observing the phenomena in question from their homes, so they're already at home when they report it. So that's kind of an odd argument for him to have made, in my opinion. Kehoe knew of cases where, quote, "the phenomenon was still there after the person reported it, and where the observer didn't wait to get home before he reported it." Condon bristled. He knew that Condon had not yet investigated any field cases personally, nor did they ever, as we now know. Nor had any members of the staff completed any meaningful research. The project was only 3 months old. "I have to admit," Kehoe told David Saunders, a key staff member, "that I'm shocked by these statements. Is this a scientific investigation or isn't it?" Well, let's go back, of course, to what they reported before the investigation ever got underway, and the New York Times themselves saying that the main thrust of this Condon Committee investigation was really to point out that, yes, the Air Force takes it seriously, and that, no, they weren't hiding anything from the public. I think that much was evident from the outset. They didn't try to hide it. It went to print in the New York Times, after all. But those problems that I've outlined are really only the beginning. Because as Fuller noted in his article, a senior member of the staff who was asked to make a speech before a teachers' association began looking for specific details on the origin of the project. He was told that he might find some information in the open files folder under the heading Air Force Contract and Background. So, long story short, he goes through these files and finds some confidential memorandums between Robert Lowe and Edward Condon. These were not intended for public release, but I want to quote from one of them. And this memo, labeled Some Thoughts on the UFO Project, stated the following, quote, "Our study would be conducted almost exclusively by non-believers, who, although they couldn't possibly prove a negative result, could and probably would add an impressive body of evidence that there is no reality to the observations." This is Robert Lowe writing this, keep in mind. He goes on to say, "The trick would be, I think, to describe the project so that, to the public, it would appear a totally objective study, but to the scientific community would present the image of a group of non-believers trying their best to be objective, but having an almost zero expectation of finding a saucer." Can you believe this? The memo goes on to say, "One way to do this would be to stress investigation not of the physical phenomena, but rather of the people who do the observing, the psychology and sociology of persons and groups who report seeing UFOs. Don't forget that. Keep that in mind." If the emphasis were put here, Lowe continued, rather than on examination of the old question of the physical reality of the saucer, I think the scientific community would quickly get the message. I'm inclined to feel at this early stage that if we set up the thing right and take pains to get the proper people involved and have success in presenting the image we want to present to the scientific community, we could carry the job off to our benefit. Great moments in the history of things that you should never write in a memorandum. Especially if there's a possibility that one of your staff members might go through it, find it, and publish it. That should never have been written down. He should have called him and talked to him. But no, Mr. Lowe had to go and write that down, actually much to our benefit, because what does that very plainly show us? What it appears to say is that the Condon Committee didn't appear to be. They very much were non-believers, and they very much had in mind what the outcome of their study would be, and they intentionally wanted the scientific community to be aware of that. They wanted to be able to communicate that clearly to them. And somehow, in the midst of all that, they presumed they could also still communicate to the public at large that there was objectivity in this study. They might have fallen for that, had the memo not aired. But after that memo leaked, and the press found out about this, things were not well back at the University of Colorado. A couple of members of the committee were actually fired, and one of them, who we'll hear about in a moment, went on to write a book called UFOs Yes, where he not only commented on the unobjective nature of the Condon Committee and its scientific evaluation of the UFO phenomenon, but he further added that he thought it was a conspiracy. Now, that was his opinion. That may not be true. But what he alleged was that based on his experience, he thought this entire thing was orchestrated by the government, hence why the Air Force was funding it, and that the intention all along had been to downplay the UFO idea. And keep in mind that all this we're discussing is before the Condon Committee actually releases its report. Remember, they hadn't actually made the report available yet. They'd only announced it had been completed. Meanwhile, J. Allen Hynek appears in the news again on July 30th, 1968, now arguing along with five other scientists during a meeting before the House Committee on Space and Astronautics, urging federal support for a huge program to collect information aimed at finally settling the debate, which has gone on for decades. Very similar to what the Russian scientists had also been arguing. We need a group of scientists, maybe an international one, to look at this subject more broadly. And to that point, skip ahead to October now, scientists consider world cooperation on UFOs. Here's the article by, yet again, Walter Sullivan reporting here for the Times. Should the nations of the world work together to present a united front to those allegedly piloting unidentified flying objects? Or is the evidence for such visitations so flimsy that the subject of UFOs does not merit serious inquiry? As he reports, both points of view had been expressed the day before at an informal meeting of space specialists held in conjunction with the Congress of the International Astronautical Federation, which took place at a Waldorf Astoria hotel. J. Allen Hynek, of course, had been on hand. The purpose, Mr. Sullivan reports, of the session was to explore the possibility of international cooperation in studying UFOs. So in the interim between the Condon Committee completing its, put up your air quotes here, objective report, and then the public release of that quote-unquote objective report, after it had been independently reviewed, if you recall. There were groups of scientists that included James McDonald, J. Allen Hynek, and others in the international community arguing that we need a global perspective on this from scientists. They were still arguing the case in that period between the completion of and the release of the Condon Committee's findings, which brings us to January 8, 1969. Here again, Walter Sullivan reporting, UFO finding, no visits from afar. That is the headline. And here's what they report. The first full-scale scientific study of unidentified flying objects or UFOs has uncovered no evidence that they are intelligently guided spacecraft from beyond the Earth, according to the final report of the project. The report brushes aside the demands of some scientists and laymen for a large-scale effort to determine the nature of such flying saucers. Such a project, the report says in effect, would be a waste of time and money. And in fact, seemingly, Condon felt the same way about the very study he had just conducted. Skipping ahead a little, they note, yesterday, however, the Associated Press circulated a fragmentary account of the principal conclusion of the Colorado study. Sources with access to the report were then willing to discuss its contents further. That's right, a summary had been leaked. I refer now to that AP report by Frank Carey. And this was titled, Investigation of Flying Saucers by Non-Governmental Scientists Completed. Secret Air Force Report Indicates No Scientific Evidence Supports Idea UFOs from Space. Washington, a secret report on an Air Force-financed investigation of flying saucers will say there is no scientific evidence to indicate that these unidentified flying objects are spaceships from another world. Informed sources told the Associated Press that this will be the primary thrust of the closely guarded report on a two-year study by a team of non-government scientists. The sources said that the report will not claim that the study produced proof that UFOs are not manned surveillance craft from outer space. You can't prove a negative, the sources said. Neither, they said, will it question the possibility that intelligent life exists beyond the Earth. Instead, it will emphasize that the investigation uncovered no scientific evidence to support contentions by various individual scientists and private organizations that flying saucers are visitors from a distant planet. Then they go on to give some specifics of the forthcoming study, but again, this is all information reported by the AP based on leaked aspects of the document. And thereafter, once it became known that information had been leaked, certain participants, including Condon, gave further commentary to the press. That was the AP report on January 7th. Walter Sullivan reports on January the 8th, and it's a lengthy article that gives further details on what was known at that point. It also touches on the fact that the Lowe memorandum being released and subsequently reported by John G. Fuller in Look magazine had caused a lot of trouble. And as a result, I want to quote from the article here in the Times. One of the guys who was causing trouble was a psychologist, Dr. David R. Saunders, who had become a member of Kehoe's committee shortly before joining the project. That is, the Colorado UFO Project. This week, a book by Dr. Saunders, written with a journalist from Boulder, R. Roger Harkins, went on sale. It is entitled UFOs, Yes. Its subtitle is Where the Condon Committee Went Wrong. The book, in paperback, was set for publication simultaneously with the issuance of the Condon Report, but it was on sale at some newsstands yesterday. They say Dr. Saunders champions a conspiracy hypothesis. That is, the Times article continues, he and Mr. Harkins argue for the possibility that the Colorado investigation was a front contrived by the highest echelons of government to mask the truth. The truth, presumably, was that UFOs are known to the government to be visitations from afar. Dr. Saunders stated, I am sure everyone on the University of Colorado project at one time or another asked himself, unless he already knew the answer, why, if the true story was cover-up, the project was allowed to exist. There were many plausible answers to this question, but they all implied that someone on the project must be acting in a double role. It was actually a pretty balanced article that appeared there in the New York Times. Just a few more quick hits there. Then on January 9th, we have scientists back report on UFOs. This, of course, after the National Academy of the Sciences completes their independent review. We also have additional reporting with excerpts from case histories appearing in the Colorado Report on UFOs, where they actually outline some of the notable highlights from the Blue Book files. The same day, January 10th, They actually have the headline, "Some UFO Cases Are Unexplained," and they talk about specifically some of the cases that the Condon Committee looked at, which include the RAF Bentwaters incident involving a radar visual encounter. So the New York Times is covering the fact that when the Condon Committee released its report, they couldn't explain some of these cases, and some of the best ones involve these radar visuals. So in January of 1969, there's still quite a lot of reporting on the topic, still quite a lot of interest, some pretty fair reporting, but also on that date, January 10th, 1969, we have this addenda, and it appears under the headline, UFOs and All That. And they report, quote, "Even before the University of Colorado report on unidentified flying objects was released yesterday, word was out among the true believers that the document was a whitewash. There was even a book already printed to contradict the work and conclusions of Professor Edward U. Condon's investigations. Evidently, many committed to the belief that reported UFO sightings prove this planet is being reconnoitered and even visited by beings from elsewhere in space will remain unpersuaded that Earth has a current monopoly on space voyagers. The experience with the Warren Commission report on President Kennedy's assassination and the minor, if lucrative, industry that has arisen out of efforts to challenge those conclusions indicates what lies ahead for the Condon report." Now, that's a really interesting point and really worthy of breaking down because, of course, when they evoke the Warren Commission, what they're talking about is the fact that as the investigation of JFK's assassination is underway by the Warren Commission, the American public is given ample time to speculate. Who might have done it? Was Russia behind this? Was the mob behind this? Was it Cuba and Castro? What's going on here? And we touched on this on Coast to Coast the other night when I was on with Jimmy. In fact, it kept coming up throughout the conversation. The way that the term conspiracy theory once meant a collusion between a couple of individuals working together to carry out an operation against another party, and how this has come to become a catch-all term for any discussion of anything really that falls outside of the norm. You know, if it's Bigfoot, if it's the Loch Ness Monster, if it's the Abominable Snowman, any of those things we touched on earlier, you know, they are called conspiracy theories, whereas in fact they are not, by definition, conspiracy theories. Many things that are lumped into that category, in other words, have nothing to do with an actual conspiracy or a theory pertaining to one. And one of the callers who actually called in had said, you know, "I appreciate the fact that you guys bring up that that term conspiracy theory appears to have been weaponized. And many have contended that that actually occurred as a result of the public's response to the Kennedy assassination as the investigation ensued, and hence the introduction of the term conspiracy theory, now with an all-new meaning and intended to convey anything that is fringe or unworthy of scientific discovery, that essentially would have been beneficial in steering the way that the public approaches these topics." And so I find it no less interesting that they specifically state that in light of the Kennedy assassination and what the Warren Commission went through, yeah, the Condon Committee's really got some fun times ahead. Returning to the article, their conclusion is that the evidence at their command up to this time does not warrant any further serious preoccupation with the problem, except possibly by students of popular psychology. The Times reporting this. They freely acknowledge that contrary evidence may arise in the future, in which case they have no objection to a reopening of the subject. Now, those two key points are very important, because here we have the Times presenting exactly what was being discussed in the Lowe Memorandum, basically that if you're going to study UFOs, if we aren't talking about the mental health of the experiencers, then there's little else to discuss. And then, of course, there's that more hopeful note. But we aren't saying that we shouldn't discuss or study UFOs at all, merely that in the future perhaps we can revisit these things, we can reopen the subject, to borrow their own term, if it seems warranted further on down the road. But it was with the publication of that series of articles in the New York Times, and especially the one we just referenced, that really began to drive the point home. The study has concluded. The study has found no evidence of extraterrestrial visitation. If social scientists and psychologists have any interest in studying people's persistent belief in unidentified flying objects, they can have at it. But our recommendation is science is not advancing. We're spending a whole lot of taxpayer dollars on this. And let's at very least put it aside. Well, NICAP disagreed. Many UFO believers disagreed. But the conclusions of the Condon Committee's report are far less significant at this point than what we see in response to it. Because once the information comes out, the New York Times and their UFO reporting that had been the norm going all the way back to 1966 and even before that, but really kind of having this crescendo building up to the release of the Condon Committee's report, all the UFO articles fall off the map after about January 12, 1969, with an article titled UFO Verdict, Believers Find It Unbelievable. That again, Walter Sullivan reporting in the science section. On January 27, 1969, there's one letter to the editor by a Donald E. Ehlers, who's the president of the Booth Memorial Astronomical Society. He is, to put it nicely, very dismissive of the UFO subject. And we don't hear about UFOs again in the New York Times until December of that year with the following headline, which is a noteworthy one. Air Force closes study of UFOs. Secretary says investigation can no longer be justified. They quote Edward Condon at the end of the article. And interestingly, he says that, quote, his own investigation was a bunch of damned nonsense and that he was sorry I ever got involved in such foolishness. So he had seemed to have that attitude before. And by the time the U.S. Air Force, almost a year after the results of the study, finally closes shop on Project Blue Book, by that time, Condon's saying, I'm sorry I ever got involved. But the final nail in the coffin, so to speak, actually appeared the following day. Yet again, New York Times on December 19th, one day later, features one very little brief addendum titled, appropriately, End of the UFO Hunt. The flying saucer buffs, I'm quoting here, will be discouraged, but practically everybody else will applaud the Air Force decision to close down Project Blue Book and its fruitless hunt for what are called, in bureaucratic jargon, unidentified flying objects. It is, in fact, surprising that the Air Force waited almost a year after the Condon report punctured the UFO bubble before taking this action. Now think about that for just a second. The Condon report actually found that there was no evidence that UFOs were extraterrestrial in origin. They further said that science was not benefiting from the study, but they didn't close the book on it and said that maybe the subject could be revisited. Quite remarkable, therefore, that the New York Times reported it saying that the UFO bubble had been punctured, and that it was amazing that the U.S. Air Force waited almost a year after the Condon Committee had done so. They go on to report here, some 21 years of work and hundreds of thousands of dollars of expenditure by the Air Force on this topic have produced gains neither for national security nor for science. Quite definitive in their tone by now, aren't they? No doubt the true believers will continue the quest, convinced more than ever that some bureaucratic conspiracy is seeking to hush up the news that the Earth is under extraterrestrial reconnaissance or has been visited by beings from elsewhere in the universe. This is the age of Aquarius. Astrologers are prospering, and a stand selling computerized horoscopes does a thriving business in Grand Central Station. The landing of two manned expeditions on the moon in the past 6 months only strengthens the faithful in their conviction that spaceships from other worlds are visiting this planet. All in one paragraph, look at all the things that they cram in there. They liken UFO belief, under any circumstances, to conspiracy theorizing, using that word, the C word, and then they immediately liken UFO interest to astrology. They conclude the very brief death nail article that I'm referring to here by saying, quote, but the prosaic fact is that despite a great expenditure of time, effort, and money, no really convincing evidence has been found to support such beliefs. there are better uses for the taxpayers' dollars than support of Project Blue Book. Note they say there is no evidence for support of the beliefs that they liken to astrology and conspiracy theories. Well, this article goes to print on December 19th. And there are two quick articles that follow it. December 27th, 1969, scientists discuss UFO despite plea, but at the very end of the article, they end on the following hopeful note. Dr. Lester Grinspoon, a Harvard University psychiatrist, discussed mental disorders that permit their sufferers to accept illusions and hallucinations as real. He said mental illness was not required for faith in fantasies. Seems the New York Times about face was in full effect. And then finally, December 28, 1969, scientists seek Air Force UFO data. It would prove to be a fruitless effort. And after December 28, 1969, there is essentially no UFO reporting that follows. For many months, for years in fact, with the notable exception that on June 16, 1971, an obituary for Dr. James McDonald is published, where they describe his UFO advocacy and also his apparent death by suicide with a gun and a note found seemingly indicating his intentions. But of course, the death of Dr. James McDonald is another discussion for another time. And of course, I'm not asserting any kind of conspiracy theory myself there, nor am I implying that his choice in actions there was directly influenced by the events we've discussed. Maybe we'll never really know fully what was going on there. I merely point out the fact that that was one of the only articles that they published with relevance to the UFO subject after it fell off the map. Because after 1969, that's essentially what happens. And even though the University of Colorado UFO project wasn't necessarily unbiased and objective, as indicated by the leaked memorandums and the concerns of the pro-UFO groups and many in the sciences who weren't members of those groups like NICAP, you know, despite all of the evidence on the table, despite all of the controversy and the concern, the Condon Committee report did not say UFOs do not exist. They simply said, we cannot say that these represent visits by extraterrestrials. We further state that there is no benefit to continuing scientific study of this phenomenon, but we don't say close the book. Maybe in the future, if and when warranted, this would be worth taking another look at. That, in summary, is what the report said. But the media took that generalized idea of, well, they didn't find anything, so we are no longer going to treat this like news. And that became the new norm. Talk about an about face. At times, what had been weekly, if not daily, coverage had completely dropped off the radar, pardon the pun, and there was no UFO coverage whatsoever. And based on the analysis that we presented here, the impact that the media and the way they interpret this sort of information and the tone that they take in their delivery of it to the public is very important. In fact, it is critical in terms of understanding broader social attitudes in relation to topics like this. And in contrast with it, many are talking about this incredible UFO renaissance that's been going on since 2017, which is in effect the exact opposite of what we saw in 1969. Nonetheless, it shows here again the power of the media in steering people's ideas and attitudes. But when we remove all of the reporting, all of the ideas, all the interpretations, all the scientists, all their biases, all of their advocacy, all of their doubt, all of their interests, when we take away all the attitudes at the end, what we appear to be left with, as the Condon Committee's own findings indicate, are there are some reports of unusual things seen in our skies that cannot be easily explained. In 1969, part of the reason that even the Condon Committee left that possibility on the table with some of the cases that they investigated had been the instrumental data provided by radar in some of those high-profile Blue Book cases. Today, very similar to the advent of radar, we have a very similar new technology that is helping broaden our awareness of things that may be going on in the skies, and hence the Navy has acquired video that appears to depict unidentified flying objects. Many treat this as though, oh wow, there really was a there. Many more of us knew that all along. But fundamentally, I think we have to take into consideration the ways that not only the media can effectively steer that narrative, whether or not that is their intention, but we must also acknowledge that with new technology, a new perspective is afforded us. And I think that perhaps right now, like the authors of the Condon Report had argued so many decades ago, maybe now is the time that warrants further consideration for this old problem with a new perspective and an open mind. All right, that about wraps it up, my friends. This show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control in Ogden, Utah, are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on this show is produced by Caleb Hanks, and other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. And I am, of course, Micah Hanks. On behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening. And as always, you guys stay strange out there.